Welcome to the weekly sermon podcast of Valley Grove Baptist Church. We are thankful you stopped by to hear from God's Word, to grow closer to Him, and to be inspired to reach your area of influence. All right, so if you'll remember, let's start off this way. Last week we talked about three things. Remember, I gave you a little formula last week, and if you weren't here, hopefully the person sitting next to you was here, and they can help you out, okay? Or maybe the person behind you. In that case, so or in front of you, whichever way. But anyway, so last week we talked about, I gave you a little formula. Remember, it was A plus B, B plus C equals M and A, right? And so last week we talked about the first three letters. So it's A and B. All right, so the first A is? Miss Reba was paying. She was close. See, that's what you get for sitting up front now. Y'all sit in the, you know, you can sit up. A, author. Who's the author of the book of Revelation? John, all right? And the second A stands for? Audience. Very good. Molly, paying attention, I heard that. And who was the audience? Seven churches made up of real people with real problems, okay? And then we talked about B, which is background. And we said there were three things that were the background to the book of Revelation. We said it was Roman domination, imperialism, emperor worship, so, and that led to persecution. And then some of the churches had some heretical teaching involved. And so we that's what we kind of looked at. Well, today we're going to pick up the C, which is context. Specifically, we're going to talk about the literary context of the book. And you may go, oh man, I hated that in high school. Too bad. We are going to talk about it today because it's important. Because here's the reality. I say that jokingly. Here's the reality. When you pick up your Bible and you flip to any book in the Bible, you are reading a specific, here's a word you probably hadn't heard in a while, specific genre of literature, right? So if you're reading Genesis, you're reading a particular type of literature. If you, like, Psalm 27 and then Psalm 13, right? Psalms is a specific type of literature. When you read the Gospels, right? We preached through the Gospel of John a while back. That is a specific type of literature. All in all, if throughout the Bible, there are eight different types of literature, each with its own style and each with its own methods of writing. And for about six of those, we can handle fairly easily. So for example, I'll give you an example from a psalm. When you read Psalm 50, okay, or 53, when you read that psalm and you come to the passage in the middle that said, God owns the cattle on a thousand hills. Does God literally own the cattle on a thousand hills? Like literally? No. What's that? It's called a metaphor. And what's the metaphor mean? God owns everything, right? Now, you know that because when you were younger in high school, you had to take poetry. And I hated poetry. I'm a kind of a literal person, you know, rational and logic and all that. And so we read Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. To my demise, I had to realize it was not about a literal cat on a hot roof. I didn't realize that till after way into the discussion. I was like, oh, okay, right. But it helps me read the Psalms better because I know going into it, a lot of this is metaphor. And when we read the story, like right now, I'm reading 1 Samuel in my devotional. And I know that's a narrative story. So I know going in that I am reading an accurate retelling of what actually happened. It's a nonfiction work, right? And it's a narrative story. So I'm not looking for the metaphor when it says Saul went out to face the Philistines or David slaughtered the Philistines from here to here. I'm not going, I wonder what he really meant by that. No, because we know intuitively, because we know what narrative stories are, that it literally means that a literal David went out and defeated the Philistines, right? Now, the two we have trouble with are sometimes the prophets. Come on now. Those names that are really hard to say. And sometimes the prophets are hard, but here's the one we really have trouble with. And the reason we have a trouble with Revelation is the one we have the most trouble with, because we do not have a, now we have a movie source, but we do not have a written equivalent in today's culture. And so we're stuck with when we get to Revelation, because we don't know, do we translate it narratively? Do we interpret it narratively? Do we interpret it metaphorically? Or is there some other method we need to use? When in reality, the genre of literature that a Revelation fits in has all of those in it together. And so we're stuck because we don't have that. Now, we have a movie version, which we're going to talk about, but we don't have a written version, and that makes it really hard for us to understand. And so here's what we've got to learn today together, is what genre of literature is Revelation, because that will greatly affect the way we read the book down the road. And the genre comes from the second word in the book. See, let's read it with me. You can read it in your Bible, you can read it on the screen. What's the first five words? The revelation of Jesus Christ. You see that word revelation? That's where the name of the book comes from. All right, let's read it again. The revelation of Jesus Christ. Now, we're going to talk about that phraseology more when we talk about specifically about verse 1:1 in a few weeks. But today, the word revelation right here is where the name of the book comes from. But there's a Greek word that's behind that you know as well. The Greek word is apokalypsis or apokalypto, which sounds very similar to our word apocalypse, right? Right? Apocalypse. Now, so here's what we got to define, because the type of literature that Revelation falls into is a defined literature that has its own characteristics, and that's what we're going to talk about this morning. This is called apocalyptic literature. Now, if I came up to you outside of church, say if I'd have asked you this morning at breakfast, or if I saw you in Walmart and say, when I say the word apocalypse, what's the first thing that comes to your mind?
War.
Thank you, Tanner. War, right. Bombs, end of the world, explosion, cataclysms, right? And we know this because a bunch of us have watched the apocalyptic movies, right? I remember watching way back when I was in high school, Armageddon. Right? Some of y'all young folks may not know that one, right? But us older folks. I mean, I remember sitting in the theater in Warner Robins and watching the movie and hadn't seen. And, you know, I think it was Bruce Willis, I think, is in it. And you remember his daughter and his son-in-law's on the ship, and his son-in-law draws a short straw, and he's supposed to go set off the bomb that's going to blow up this asteroid, and Bruce Willis hits the thing, goes back up, and Bruce Willis saves the day, right, so his son-in-law can go back and be married to his daughter and all that. It's a great movie, right? But it's about a world-ending asteroid. And then how many of you watch Day After Tomorrow? Climate change heavy in that one, because we're ruining the world. All of this stuff's going to happen, and we're going to freeze to death, right? And then there's Day After Tomorrow. Then there's the movie 2012. And then there's Deep Impact, right? And how many of you, some of y'all were not, maybe not even born at this point, or some barely born. How many of y'all remember how everybody was in a panic for Y2K? The world is going to end. Your car's going to stop running. Your computer's going to shut down. I mean, my dad had a friend who lived in South Georgia whose pastor was up there telling the church they need to buy water and long-term survival supplies, because Y2K is going to be the end. Well, obviously it wasn't, right? And then how many of you remember 12 years later, the world was in a panic because the Mayan long count calendar ended? Right? We are drawn to these end of the world, cataclysmic bombs and war and da-da-da. And if we're not careful, we'll allow that cultural idea to influence the way we read Revelation. So the question we need to ask is, does this word, the revelation of Jesus Christ, apocalypse, does it mean what culture says it means, or is there another definition for what it really means? Right? That's a good question. Culture, in the all-around possibility, culture could be right. But is it right? Because if it's not right, then we need to allow the real definition to influence the way we lead the book. Unfortunately, culture's not right when it comes to this specific word. That word apocalypse in the Greek language literally means to reveal someone or something. Did you hear that? What did it not mean? Boom. Okay? Look. I don't know if you've seen, if you have Facebook. The image that we're using for our series of Revelation, okay? Because I Googled this before I created it, okay? I Googled sermon series on Revelation because I wanted to see what other images other churches were using, okay? And there's a reason that we specifically created the imaging the way we did for the series. If you'll look, it's a like multi kind of shade of greenish blue teal background, and it has a picture of a lion, has a picture of a lamb, and the lion has a crown on it. And on one side it has an alpha and omega symbol, and then on the other side it has a cross with a, and then on the bottom it has a crossed scepter like for a king, and then it has a shepherd's crook. There's a reason I chose that style of image versus what I saw on the internet. There was one church who literally had like an atomic bomb explosion. Or like the world was on fire. Or like it was like blazing flames and all this. So the question, why didn't I choose that versus what we chose? Literally, because the word right here doesn't mean cataclysm. So the imagery that these other churches have chosen and how they style their series through imaging tells you kind of where they're headed, or unless they're doing like a play on kind of words kind of thing. But the reason I chose this is because the word revelation right here, the real definition of apocalypse means to reveal someone or something. So when we read verse 1 and it says, the revelation of Jesus Christ, when we read that, we should not hear the blowing up of the world, the cataclysmic events, nuclear bombs, and war of Jesus Christ. We should instead hear the revealing of Jesus Christ. That means, what does that fundamentally mean about the book and about apocalyptic literature in general? It is more concerned about showing you something than it is about cataclysm. Now, we're going to get in the book, and there is some of that in there. But the cataclysm serves the purpose of revealing something or someone. Everybody with me? So the genre of literature that the book and the writing that John, the style that he takes, is primarily about revealing something to us about someone or something. Now you say, what is the someone or something that's being revealed? And what is it? Well, you got to stick around and find out. Like, that's why he wrote the book, right? But so we need to get out of our minds that the primary fundamental purpose for which John wrote this is, it's not that. It instead is about revealing someone or something. And that will drastically, if you go into the book with that in mind, that one thing alone will drastically change the way you read the book. So I just kind of give you a hint. John is less concerned about you knowing when the world's going to end. That is, does Revelation contain kind of end of the world, like end of the way life is right now stuff? Yes. But that is a secondary or tertiary concern. That is not John's main concern in the book. It is not a calendar of how things are going to end or when things are going to end. It is about revealing something about someone or something. Okay? So that's the first thing you need to know about apocalyptic literature. It is revealing. That's why translators chose the word revelation. Right? And you know this intuitively in other verses in the Bible. For example, I'm going to read you Galatians 1:12. Paul, this is Paul, a letter that Paul writes to the Galatian believers. Listen to it. For I did not receive it. The word it there is referring back to the previous verse, which identifies it as the gospel. For I did not receive the gospel from human sources, and I was not taught it, but it came by a revelation from Jesus Christ. That word revelation there is the same one here. It is apocalypse. Now, you would never say, you would never interpret this verse, for I did not receive it from, I did not receive the gospel from a human source, and I was not taught it, but it came about by cataclysmic events. You wouldn't read Paul that way, and so you shouldn't read John that way either, because the word is exactly the same. And in fact, the vast majority, almost every time the word revelation or apocalypse is used in the New Testament, it is always used about revealing something or someone. It's about revealing, a letting come to know about someone or something. And so that's the first thing. Now, how did apocalyptic literature come about? Well, not to bore you with all the details, but it is an amalgamation of various sources. It started in Persia. And then it came via Persia to Israel, to the Jews, and then the Jews kind of developed it a little bit further, and then John picks it up because he's a Jew. And so it was kind of a series of about several hundred years that this type of literature develops. The main thing you need to know is why would somebody, or how do they use it? Like, what are some of the characteristics of apocalyptic literature, and why would somebody use it? Well, here's some of the characteristics. It tells fantastic stories. And I don't mean fantastic in the sense of good, but it is like over the top, right? I mean, it spares no expense of detail, and it uses imagery and metaphor and simile, and it has a very simple point. So the point could be like this, but John is going to build this entire story. It's somewhat like a play or like a drama or like a theater. You know, sometimes plays and drama, they have a very simple point, right? That they could just get up there on stage and say, hey, here's what the story is about in one sentence. Psst. But instead of doing that, what do? They have all of these moving parts and characters with lines and songs, and they build out, and then you have to weave together all of that to get to that one little kernel of truth. And that's in some way the way apocalyptic literature is it builds these fantastic stories and does all of this imagery to get you to a very simple point. Here's the other thing. It uses a lot of numbers. And the numbers are meant to be interpreted metaphorically. And you're going to see in Revelation, there's a lot of numbers, right? So we talked about one of the most famous numbers in Revelation. You know what it is, right? 666, right? Well, we'll talk about this more when we get there, but did you know that in this kind of numerology where numbers have meaning, do you know that 6 is like incomplete? So it could be incomplete, 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 which is triply incomplete, right? So it may not even be a person at all. Really? The number 3 is the number of divinity. The number 7 is the number of completion. The number 12 has significance. And what is 12 groups of 12? 144. There's just 144,000. Like, you know, one group, one sect of Christianity, kind of a cultish group of Christianity, said that there were only going to be 144,000 believers until they got more than 144,000, and then they had to reinterpret the verse, right? And it's like, well, maybe you interpreted it wrong from the beginning, which they absolutely did. And so in Revelation, numbers may not necessarily mean exactly that number. It may be a metaphor for something else, because that is the way in which it's meant to be read. And you have some other things that we'll talk about as we go on. But here's the big question that I want to leave you with today, or we kind of need to hang on today, is why would somebody write this way anyway? I'm going to be honest with you. John's message, and I don't want to spoil it, because you're going to have to come back to kind of get it, but John's message is very simple. Very simple. And in fact, John could have wrote the answer to the question, why did John write? He could have wrote his message in one sentence. One sentence. But he doesn't. So the question is, why can't he? All right, back up. What did we say was happening last week? Roman domination, imperial might and will, and persecution. And so put yourself in John's shoes and the seven churches who received the letter in their shoes. So both of them know that Christians are actively being persecuted. And so what do you think would happen to the receiver of a letter that stated very quickly something to the effect of, God is more powerful than Rome, Jesus Christ will win the end, He will conquer the Roman Empire, He will defeat the emperor, da 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 da. What do you think would happen to the receiver of that letter if the government found out about it? What would happen? You know what would happen, right? Thank you. Absolutely. What do you think would happen to the sender of the letter? The same, like, you know the answer. And so why does John and why does apocalyptic literature spring up? It springs up so that you and I can communicate together, and so I can write in such a way that you know what I'm saying, but the person who's trying to kill us all doesn't know what we're saying. And so it's born out of necessity, and it arises. And if you look at kind of the history of how it formed, when did the Jews use it? Like the Jews prior to Christ, during the Greek and Roman occupation of Israel, it springs up and they write these fantastic, very much like Revelation in symbols and numbers and all that. But it's to get the point that God will vindicate us all and He will kick the Greeks out. Because I can't say that literally or else I'll be killed. But I can, because of social upheaval and persecution, I can write in such a way that you and I can communicate together without anybody else knowing about it. And you and I can encourage you to say, hey, stick it out. God's going to win in the end. Without actually saying those specific words. And so the reason that Revelation springs up is a reason John chooses to use that style versus the epistle that we just finished going through is because of the persecution, the social upheaval, and the domination by the government. And he wants to communicate truths to his readers that they'll understand that the government won't and they won't get. So he uses images of beasts and dragons and riders on horses with scales and all of this kind of stuff, right? To portray a very simple message, but in fantastic form, so that if you don't know what the meaning is, you're going to go, this guy's crazy. And you're just going to pass it along and say, whatever. But there's real truths that are meant to encourage the readers of the letter because they're going through real problems. And so that's why John uses this type of literature. And I'm going to give you three examples from the Old Testament really quickly as we end today to show you how this works. Daniel is the first. Now, there's three little pieces in the Old Testament. Daniel, Ezekiel, and Zechariah all use this kind of like over-the-top apocalyptic imagery. Daniel uses it in chapters 7 through 12. We preached on Daniel several years ago, verse by verse, like we're doing through Revelation several years ago. And Daniel tells these fantastic stories of rams and goats and idols, statues that get cut down, and kings of the north, and you know all of this stuff he talks about. But he uses all of these numbers and symbols and imagery. But if you get to the heart of the message, Daniel's message is very simple, and I've got it in your outline. But let's look over it. Daniel's message is very simple. Here's what it is: throughout history, God's people will experience persecution, just like the people he was writing to were experiencing persecution at the moment. But God knows the future because it's His story to tell. But here's Daniel's big message. If you want to say, what's the end of Daniel all about? It's really this simple. God wins, and so do His people. That's it. You read Daniel 7 through 12, and if you cut through all of the imagery and all of the numbers and all of the stuff, Daniel's message is very simple. God wins. Go read the scene where the people try to conquer Israel, try to conquer God's people. And what happens? It's not even a fight. God obliterates everybody and saves His people. Go read the book of Ezekiel, chapter 38 and then 39 tell one story, and 40 through 48 tell another story, both of which are in apocalyptic imagery. And go to the scene in verse 30, chapter 38 and 39, where Gog and Magog, have this fantastical army, and they're coming down on God's people. And It's not even a battle. And what's Ezekiel's message? God wins. He conquers evil. He destroys all of his foes, and his people are saved. But why can't he tell that story? And why can't Daniel, instead of writing chapter 7 through 12, just write in verse 7, 1, God wins in the end and saves his people? And why can't Ezekiel just cut out chapters 38 through 48 and just say, hey, God's going to win. He's going to kill all of his enemies. He's going to save his people. Just trust in him. Because both of them were taken from their homes and were in captivity against their will in a foreign country. And the message that they're writing is about the foreign country who they're in captivity in. They can't say that. So what does Daniel do? He writes in apocalyptic style, so that the people who read it, who are in captivity with him, and Ezekiel the same way, who are in captivity with him, will understand the message that God will win in the end. And it may not be today, but God will vindicate his holiness and his righteousness, and he will save his people. And so it's a message of encouragement to keep on with God, that don't give up on God because he hasn't given up on you. When we come to Zechariah, Pastor Adam on Wednesday talked about Zechariah at length. And Zechariah is the same thing. He gives this fantastic imagery kind of toward the end of his book about God defeating his foes and all of these like zombie-like creatures at the end. And you're like, whoa, what's going on? And again, the message is still the same. And the message is that the Messianic kingdom, that God will come and he will provide healing for the nations. But also, Zechariah asks the questions, will you be faithful to God's covenant? And so in the end, Zechariah is saying the same thing that Ezekiel and Daniel are. Will you be faithful to God? Because he is going to be faithful to you in the end. And he will conquer all of his foes, no matter who they are or where they come from. And one day, heaven and earth will meet, and they will be one like they were all the way back in the beginning in the Garden of Eden. And that's kind of why and how people use this type of literature. And that's exactly why John writes Revelation. So where does this apply to us today? Well, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to look around and see that in some sense, while we have great freedoms here today, there are brothers and sisters in parts of the world that don't. I mean, you can just go up north, and if you keep going, you'll get in Canada. And Canadian pastors do not have the liberty to say what I can say today. Now, we're not talking about communist China. We're just talking about Canada. They don't have freedom of speech in the way that we do. But then you go to other parts of the world, and literally they could be killed for being a Christian. China has this entire network of what they're called underground churches. One of my professors in seminary, he's a great guy, phenomenal pastor, great teacher, loved his class. He went on a mission trip to China. And you know what he did? His goal was, his job was to teach Bible teachers and preachers, because he's a PhD guy, you know, great scholarly guy. His job was to teach. He was doing a workshop for pastors and Bible teachers. And you know what they had to do? They had to go in a room in somebody's house, like a living room in this apartment complex. They had to sing worship songs in silence. Like they just mouthed the words. They didn't vocalize the word, they mouthed them. And then he taught for like 12 hours straight and barely at a whisper. Why? Because the neighbor next door might turn him into the government. Right? So what message do you think they need to hear? Oh man, hey, be ready for the cataclysm. No, they need to hear God's going to beat the communists in China. It may not be today, but one day, He's going to defeat all of his enemies. And he's going to save you, just like he did, just like Daniel's message said, just like Ezekiel, and just like Zechariah said. And eventually, just like John says, right? And when you're in the moment, in the shadow, in the valley of the shadow of death, do you really need to hear about the cataclysm? No. Because you could care less about the cataclysm in that moment, right? Let's be real. You don't need some prophecy expert telling you how to put some facts together on their nifty little chart. What do you need? You need God, you need Jesus to be revealed in your life that He is bigger than your problem, that He is bigger than your situation, and that He, in the end, will conquer all sin, death, hell, and the grave. And it can be applied to your life in that moment, in that second, in that day. And that is why John writes in the style that he does, to get a very simple message across that you and I need to hear today. And at the end of the day, here's kind of to cut to the chase. Like, we're going to go through the book, but I'm going to, like, here, John's message, Jesus wins. That's it. Jesus wins, and He will conquer every foe. You know that little verse? You know the little verse that Paul writes in Philippians? It's Philippians 2, like 5 through 11. It's this great Christological, Jesus-focused message. And it's very fascinating. But at the end of that, and I believe it's around verse 9 through 11 in Philippians 2. You can go read it this afternoon. I'd encourage you to. Here's what it says. Every knee will bow, and every tongue will confess that Jesus Christ is Lord. Those in heaven, on earth, and under the earth, right? Every knee will bow. Can I just give you? That's exactly what John is going to show us in imagery and fantastic stories through numbers. And he's telling real people who have real problems, just like you and I, that at one point, every knee will bow and every tongue will confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, both those in heaven, those on earth, and those under the earth. And in the valley of the shadow of death, Jesus is just as in control, and he can win in your situation just like he can win at the end of the world. And that is why John writes the way he does. Thanks for listening. For more information about Valley Grove, visit our Facebook page or website, valleygrovechurch.org.